Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time. Baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.
Thank you, Dave. We're going to talk about misinformation here. Nearly all Americans say misinformation online is a problem, and about 60% say they're concerned their friends or family are part of the problem, but I think it's only like 20% that think they are part of the problem. So who is it? How big of a problem is it? And how do you handle somebody you know sharing fake news? Well, Phil Napoli joins us now, professor of public policy at Duke, author of Social Media in the Public Interest, Media Regulation in the Disinformation Age. Good morning, Phil. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good, thanks.
At this point, Phil, how you define truth, how you define what is accurate information and what isn't. Because the lines have been blurred so much. Is that where we start with this or not?
Yeah, I think the challenge right now is the institutions, the organizations that we traditionally trusted to define truth for us, trust in all of them has diminished dramatically. So people are willing to look to some new places for what they consider truth.
And the reason I ask that is this will really start messing with your mind, especially in this job that I have, because you start trying to find absolute truth, and it really is hard to discern when there are so many different sources and there are so many different blatant biases that enter into it. There are also subconscious biases, perhaps, that enter into it, and sometimes a story is just not told correctly in terms of what it is that you hear and read or passing on. Was there a tipping point where this happened where, let me tell you my story real quick, if I can, Phil.
Sure.
High school football, long time ago, my coach was quoted as saying that the West Bank was bubbling football. And I can't imagine this man having said that. And I said, did you really say that? He said, hell no, I didn't say that. So at that point, from that point on, I'm wondering, well, everything I read and see, how do I know if it's real or not? So how does somebody determine what is truth and what is a reliable source? And I'm not trying to get too philosophical here, but...
Well, that is that's the million-dollar question. And I think if you think in the past... The issue was, the difference is that the variation, the range of variation was narrower. And now we can see swings from from one extreme to the other, and every little point in between. So really this begins, that was part of, I think, your question initially. This begins when our media environment grew so fragmented. And by fragmented, we mean an environment like the internet where the barriers to entry were so low, where anybody, as we often hear this phrase used in journalism, now everybody is a journalist. Well, oops, maybe that wasn't such a good idea. But the opportunities to participate and to be a content creator and a content distributor are so widely available. But that was when that got coupled with then what the social media platforms do, which is serve as this amplification mechanism for select bits of that content. That was really the dangerous combination because, you know, if it's the late 90s or early 2000s, you had to make an active effort to go out there and be, you know, dangerously misinformed. But now you can be passive and it can get delivered to you while you're scrolling through a news feed looking at video of skateboarding bulldogs.
You had to go out of your way to be, what was the word you used, drastically misinformed?
Now you can be dangerously misinformed.
Dangerously misinformed. Now it'll just passively active for you. It'll passively happen for you as you're scrolling through bulldogs riding surfboards. Well, there's the quote of the day, I'll tell you that. How do you even begin to sort through this mess of disinformation? If somebody, because you see, here's the disconnect. 60% of people say that there is misinformation, disinformation is a problem, that they think their friends or relatives are doing it, but only 20% think they're doing it. So apparently a lot more people are doing it than they realize.
Yep. In my field, there's a long history of that distinction that we call it the third person effect. People always used to say, if you say, hey, do you think the news media or violent programming or whatever type of media has an effect on you? The answer was often no. But if you then ask those same people, how much of an effect do you think it's having on others? The answer is quite a strong effect. So, yes, we seem to be quite, we place ourselves on a bit of a pedestal and tend to think less of all of the folks around us. That is a pattern that we see repeated over and over again. But certainly in today, if you talk to a person who is actively consuming and sharing this information, they have no self-awareness about that. They oftentimes feel as if they have cracked the code and beat the system and have figured out the truths that other people are blinded to. So there's that perception that accompanies this, which makes it such a hard thing. There's so few stories out there of people saying, oh, I used to be down this rabbit hole and then somebody got me out of it, or I got myself out of it. We're hearing far too few of those stories.
And I was going to ask you that because I know a lot of people that are down rabbit holes, and once they go down that way, they don't come out, because then they start questioning everything and they start questioning what they questioned originally, which leads to a question of questioning. And then before you know it, everything's a conspiracy and nothing is true, et cetera, right?
Right. And there's always another piece of information out there you could point to that will save you from the fate that's worse than death, I think, for most people, which is admitting that you were wrong.
Yes, nobody wants. Well, I've learned a long time ago, it's a lot easier just to do it than to talk yourself into a corner. So how would you go about even riding the ship? Let me take a quick break here, and then we'll pick it up when we come back. Because I know the Founding Fathers and the First Amendment guarantees freedom of speech. I guess it's the same as farmers leaning on their fence post made of timbers and sharing something that's not true. That's a lot different than it is today with social media. So how do you go about governing this? And again, you got people that, even though it is false, and that's, I guess, the difference between misinformation and disinformation, they'll purposely put it out there to try to sway somebody to going down their rabbit hole. And it's really will fool with your mind, man, when you try to think about what's really true and what's not and make an informed decision. We're talking with Phil Napoli, professor of public policy at Duke, author of Social Media and the Public Interest, Media Regulation in the Disinformation Age. And I would ask you, just in terms of something that's happened in your neighborhood or when you see the story written up, is it really what happened? Because not only is there intentional bias, there can sometimes be just people not doing their jobs, not doing factual reporting. 920 back in a flash, WWL. It is 925, Tuesday, October 12th, 2021, day 44 of the Ida recovery. And I say that because as we talk to Phil Napoli, professor of public policy at Duke, author of Social Media and the Public Interest, Media Regulation and the Disinformation Age, about nearly all Americans say misinformation online is a problem, and 60% say that their friends and family are engaged in it. I made a note on my iPhone, Phil, back on January 7th of 2020 at 6:40 a.m. about versions of the truth. And President Trump said that the stiffest, we had the stiffest sanctions against Iran, which was true and not true, because I don't know if that date's accurate or not. Anyway, now I'm questioning my own dates. Because it was the toughest sanctions by the USA, but not tougher than UN sanctions of which the USA was a participant. And the only reason I bring all of that up is when you try and to discern, and after speeches, you know, they do fact-checking and so forth, and you give them a partial lie, this is a little bit of a lie, that much of a lie. how would you even go about, and that's why I started our conversation by asking you, how do you define the truth? Because if you're going to police somebody about putting out the truth, you got to figure out what it is first and find out when they're putting out what is not the truth. Yes?
Right. Absolutely. And what you're describing, I think we would all be nostalgic for the days when it was those issues of matter of degree, right? Yeah, partially true.
The good old days, right?
It's the whoppers that my friend Bill Adair, who created PolitiFact, who works with me here, you know, they call them, their label is pants on fire. Mm-hmm. They're untruths that are so flagrant. And those, unfortunately, are where the bigger problems lie these days. I think fact checkers, perform a useful function in terms of their ability to, in theory, objectively offer some, evaluation of whether something is truthful or not. Unfortunately, today we start to hear people say things like, well, what we need are more conservative fact checkers. What we need are more liberal fact checkers. If you talk to a fact checker, they will tell you that those are contradictions in terms. That's the whole point of being a fact checker, that it operates independent of liberal or conservative bias. And again, that might be to some degree a bit of wishful thinking, but it is truly what those folks aspire to do. The problem is today, they too are falling into the bucket of organizations and institutions that people are growing to distrust.
So when you talk about numbers and people, the good old days and so forth, do we have any idea how much disinformation there is out there or misinformation? I guess misinformation goes to information that you knowingly pass along that you think is correct, and disinformation is information you pass along that you knowingly know is false, but you're trying to prove your side or gain some advantage for your side, whatever that is?
Absolutely right. So that issue of intention is what distinguishes it, which of course makes it difficult, if not impossible, to say, well, there's this much of what's out there is misinformation and this much of what's out there is disinformation, because how do you really get at, right? You know, how do you truly know the intent of anybody who's producing or sharing this this content? But to the answer of how much is really out there, one of the biggest problems that has become a little more high profile now is the fact that we don't exactly know, because a lot of these platforms are not really being as forthcoming with their own data and their own research. I mean, that was a key point of the congressional hearings with the whistleblower from Facebook last week. Those of us academic researchers who've worked with these platforms often find that the data we get are either incomplete or we don't get access to the to everything that we want. I'd love to be, and sometimes this becomes a tricky part too, which is, do we take these numbers as a glass half empty or glass half full? If a study gets released that says, oh, only about 5% of what people were exposed to was disinformation. Well, does it take more than that for a huge problem to be created? So it's always hard, I think, to objectively answer the question of whether there's a lot or a little out, too much or a dangerous amount. What is that number? It's a really hard thing to answer.
And then there's the worry, the concern about it becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy, or it becomes true even though it started as false. And we had a terrible incident here last week where a girl slapped and beat down a teacher, the 64-year-old disabled teacher in a classroom. Initially, they said it was part of a TikTok challenge where one was photographing the other beating down the teacher, and come to find out there is not a TikTok challenge that is a hoax, but there are people that are listening right now that are convinced that it is. So at what point, if it gets reported that it is a TikTok challenge, even though it isn't, that teens start to do this because they think it is a TikTok challenge, and there's a spiral down a rabbit hole, right?
Absolutely. And there's a key part of the cycle you just described there as well, which is, there are huge swaths of our local, national journalism ecosystem that is that are reporting on things without doing, unfortunately, the necessary due diligence. We saw this a month or so back with the case where in Oklahoma there was the report from a single emergency room doctor that hospitals were flooded with people who are overdosing on the ivermectin. And then Rolling Stone picked up that story from a little local Oklahoma TV station that had interviewed exactly one person and had not done any confirmation of anything that he had said. And then it gets picked up by Rolling Stone, and then it ends up on NBC, and it sort of snowballs from there. So that complicates things if we have, journalists that are not doing the necessary due diligence and sort of are contributing to the hysteria.
And I think part of it is that everybody's trying to run leaner and leaner. And while some think there's an agenda, I think sometimes it's just people trying to meet deadlines and like you're saying, taking shortcuts, not doing what they're supposed to be doing. Somebody texted in and said, saying that it's a lie or false doesn't necessarily make it so. But you could also say the corollary to that is saying that it's a fact or true doesn't necessarily make it so. And before we let you go, I'm thinking here on this October 12th, and this goes back a long time, and I guess it goes to urban myths that are now, well, let me take a step back first. Are we now in a land where urban myths are becoming everyday accepted facts?
Well, if the urban myth appeals to your existing preconceptions and biases, unfortunately, that's the approach people will take to a lot of urban myth these days. We talk a lot about confirmation bias, and that is the biases we bring that determine how we process the news and information that's presented to us. And we are seeing increasingly that people are willing to embrace falsity if it conforms with their worldview.
And a lot of this is not unintentional, because some of it has nefarious goals behind it, as in foreign governments or political parties or manipulations here or there. The other thing where people are being played and they don't realize it, right?
Absolutely. And the strategies there change all the time. The thing that always comes to mind for us is sort of Russian activity on Facebook. Well, guess what? The most recent data suggests that the new playground for Russian disinformation specialists is the comment sections of news sites. So if you scroll down and read the comments of a news story, there's a decent chance that there's some Russian trolls in there commenting on the stories and trying to push debate and discussion in particular directions.
One other thing I've noticed is that it seems like Twitter especially, people feel compelled to comment on something when they don't really have anything to say. And from that point, it can take conversations into a completely different realm. Is that part of it as well, maybe, where people just, if you don't have anything to say, just don't say it?
Yeah, again, hate to use that term, good old days again. But yes, when we put these tools in people's hands, it's cultivated a level of narcissism, I think, that helps explain what you're describing, which is people feeling very comfortable and very qualified to have and express opinions on things that they really don't have enough knowledge or sufficient expertise to have opinions about.
So emergency rooms have been x-raying candy for years and years now on Halloween, and I don't think, as far as I know, and it's kind of be like proving a negative, I don't know of any reported incident where somebody has actually put a razor blade in an apple or a needle in a piece of candy, have they, that you know of?
Not that I'm aware of, but I remember being told to watch out for that when I was a kid trick-or-treating.
Incredible. Thank you, Phil. I appreciate your time. I really do. Phil Napoli, professor of public policy at Duke, author of Social Media in the Public Interest, Media Regulation in the Disinformation Age. We take a quick break. When we come back, big news about the development of the Six Flags abandoned amusement park in New Orleans.
Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time. Baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.